the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Well, as Nick said, we're continuing in Job. Gemma very carefully took us through the first two chapters. So Gemma had three voices. We've got two voices, as you've heard already. We've got Job, that's chapter 3, and Eliphaz, chapters 4 and 5. We've just taken a taster of what they both said. I'm very conscious that this is feels a bit depressing, doesn't it? When you listen to what Job says, it's not an uplifting message, but it's something which is in his heart. It's a genuine emotion and quite understandable. And I think we need to be very conscious that this is someone who has been through the ringer and is at the end of his tether. And the difficulty I face is that when Eliphaz comes in, his advice is not necessarily the best. If you've probably heard the phrase Job's comforters, people who come alongside with the best will in the world to make things better, and what do? They just make things worse. And so that's what we've got in Eliphaz. So in fact, all the way from chapter 3 all the way through to chapter 37 is a dialogue between Job and his friends. And I have to say, they are friends. There are people who come alongside him. So they are, and this is dialogue. Job says something, one of his friends says something. Job says something in reply, another of his friends says something. And we go through about three cycles of that. Nearly all his friends have three goes at this. And it's very much the same message at each time. And what strikes me is it's, if you ever read a whodunit, like an Agatha Christie or there's more modern ones, I can't think of some more modern detectives, my brain's gone blank, but there's loads of whodunits you can get in the shops. And what you do is you read the early chapters and you get a sort of certain picture of what's happening, but it doesn't really make sense till you get to the end. And then you look back and think, ah, now that makes sense. And that's what we've got a bit with sort of, especially when Eliphaz is speaking, he doesn't quite get it right. He's not entirely right. The trouble is, he's half right. He's got most of it right, but he draws the wrong conclusions. In a sense, his doctrine is correct, but his application is wide of the mark. So we have to read it with that understanding. The only danger is with this, and it's a word of warning, Agatha Christie, very neat answers, all sorts itself out. You think, okay, that's all very clear, and that's why it doesn't happen. This is real life. This is someone who has lost wealth, health, family. He has lost his reputation. He has lost everything. And in that circumstance, there aren't neat solutions. And that's one of the messages that Eliphaz thinks there's a neat answer, and there isn't. There's not a single word that says, that sorts it, and Job goes away, okay. And we finish at chapter 5. No, we go all the way on into chapter 42. So, what do we see? Well, we're going to see what Job has to say, first of all. And Job has this, life is not worth it. We see this in verse 3 of chapter 3, where he says, may the day of my birth perish, and the night that said a boy is conceived. He just thinks, I wish I'd never been born. And then he goes on, and he just builds on this. And he says in verse 13, he says, for now I would be lying down in peace. I would be asleep and at rest. He's basically saying, look, I'd be better off dead. The dead have it easy. They have it nice and quiet. They don't have hassles. They don't have difficulties. Nothing as quiet as the grave. Nothing as peaceful as the grave. And he sums it all up in verse 26. I have no peace, no quietness. I have no rest, but only turmoil. And we have to be honest. Sometimes in life, our lives will be turned upside down. And that turmoil is perfectly understandable. You may have seen the book, the film Shadowlands, which talked the story of C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis, a Christian writer from sort of middle of last century, huge influence in his time, an academic, who, you know, very much an ivory tower academic, and he met, he got married late in life as a total surprise. He fell in love, somebody who lived in a very much a male academic world. And as he got married, his wife died from cancer. And they had a few glorious years together. And in a sense, God took that away. He didn't know that joy before, but God gave him that joy and then took it away, very much like Job. And this is what he says in the book he wrote about it, A Grief Observed. It says N.W. Clarke. He wrote it under a pseudonym to start with. In it he says, "Where is God? This is one of the most disquieting symptoms. When you are happy, so happy that you have no sense of needing him, so happy that you're tempted to feel his claims upon you as an interruption, if you remember yourself and turn to him with gratitude and praise, you will be, or so it feels, welcomed with open arms. But go to him when your need is desperate, when all other help is vain. What do you find? A door slammed in your face and a sound of bolting and a double bolting on the inside." There's a sense of abandonment. I've been pushed away by God. God has abandoned me. And that can be very hard for us as Christians to hear someone saying that. But sometimes people will feel like that. And what we can do, sometimes the best we can do, is just come along beside them and be with them. Maybe not come up with a slick answer. Maybe not try and solve their problems, but just come alongside them. And it struck me, if you look back in chapter 2, it says in verse 13, this is friends come and see Job, and they say, they sat on the ground with him for 7 days and 7 nights. No one said a word to him because they saw how great his suffering was. Come alongside someone. If you see someone suffering, don't think you have to solve their problem. Don't think you have to come up with a clever Bible verse which just click and it's all gone. Maybe just come alongside them. Sit with them. Maybe put your arm around them and just be with them. And let them know they are loved. Maybe that's all you need to do. The next thing Job asks is this question, why, which Nick touched on. He asks why again and again. Chapter 3, verse 11, why did I not perish at birth? Verse 12, why were there knees to receive me? Verse 16, why was I not hidden away in the ground? Verse 20, why is light given to those in misery and life to the bitter of soul? Verse 23, why is life given to a man whose way is hidden? Again and again he asks why. And it all boils down into this phrase, why is life given to someone when life is miserable? And he just doesn't know. And now, going back to what I said there about not coming up with clever answers, that is sometimes what the temptation is. Someone asks you why, and you feel duty-bound to give the right, correct doctrinal answer. And I have struggled with preparing for tonight, because it's gone round my mind. And I think one of the reasons I've struggled with tonight is that I see myself in Eliphaz, that as he answers, I think, ooh, that's the sort of thing I would say. And you begin to realize that maybe I've been trying too much to answer the people's theological questions, but you don't care enough about them as a person and what they're going through. Part of the reason is I'm an engineer, and one of the things engineers love to do is solve problems. And you give a problem to an engineer, and they leap at it, and they try and answer it. I'll give you one example. When I first started work, I worked for a company, and one of the senior partners built big gate structures. He designed structures, not this one. This isn't one he's done up. This is one up in New York. But he designed these big gate structures on rivers, And that was his forte. And he had a reputation for that, not only in the UK, but across Europe. He used to travel around Europe. One day there was a problem. Some client came to him and said, we've got a problem. You know, this location here, can't get the flows right and things aren't quite right. What did he do? He leapt straight in to a solution. I will design you a gate. It's only when one of the other partners looked at him and said, you don't need to do anything. No, this will solve itself. It will work itself out. It's not an issue. It's not a problem. And so often we want to solve things. We want to be the ones who come up with the right answer. And sometimes I read testimonies of people and they're talking about how they've helped someone. And they say, someone came to me with a problem and I gave them this Bible verse. And they said, yes. And they went away happy. It doesn't always happen like that. Don't necessarily leap to solution mode. What does God say to Eliphaz at the end? He says in chapter 42, he says, after the Lord had said these things to Job, he said to Eliphaz the Temanite, I am angry with you and your friends because you have not spoken to me what is right. And I feel like there's a sense that maybe we need to put some of these sort of disclaimers on what Eliphaz says. You say, the views expressed here are not necessarily the views of the publisher. So, whether it's a television program or whether it's a newspaper. The views expressed here are not necessarily correct. Bit of a controversial statement maybe, but just get it in context. Not everything you read in the Bible is true. Not everything that is written here is true. And Eliphaz gets things some things wrong. So we need to unpick that. And how we do that and pick that is by looking across the whole of God's story, the whole of the book of Job, and the whole of what God has done. Because Job, in his time, was looking forward to a redeemer. Of course, we are looking back to that redeemer has come. So we are seeing a different place in this story. So that's the warning. It doesn't mean to say that Eliphaz doesn't have some wisdom, but he doesn't always get it right. So let's have a look at what he says. First thing he says is, to put it simply, Job chapter 4, verse 8 and 9. Let's look at that. He says, as I observed, those who plow evil and those who sow trouble reap it. At the breath of God they perish. At the blast of his anger they are no more. So in other words, God is a God of justice and he will bring punishment upon those who do wrong. Job, something's gone wrong. You must have done something wrong yourself. You're being punished by God. And it's very easy for us to make that leap, to say, yes, someone has done, is suffering. Why, what have you done to cause that punishment, that suffering to come upon you? And it's interesting that Eliphaz almost loses his patience. As you go through the book of Job, he starts off at the beginning of chapter 4, he's almost generous. He says, your words have supported those who have stumbled. You have strengthened faltering knees. By the time of his third speech, Eliphaz says to Job, is not your wickedness great? Are not your sins endless? You can see what's behind his mind. He thinks Job is a bad man, in a sense. He's done something wrong, and he's desperate to prove it. Yes, Eliphaz is right. God is a God of justice. Yes, sin does have consequences. Paul talks about in Galatians, he says, you reap what you sow. But we know Job is a righteous man. Why do we know that? Go back to chapter 1, verse 8. Then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? There's no one on earth like him. He's blameless and upright. He's blameless and upright. I mean, Eliphaz could have seen that. He didn't need to say to Job, your wickedness is great. Are not your sins endless? He knew what Job was like. But because he was so convinced of his doctrinal correctness, he ignored the truth in front of him. And sometimes suffering doesn't come because of a specific sin. Sometimes suffering is part of life. The commentary puts it like this. Many times the innocent do suffer, and often the wicked seemingly have no problems. This was Job's point throughout the book. Eliphaz's view of an airtight doctrine of retribution does not jibe with reality. And we just look around us, this world, and innocent people suffer. There's victims of crime. There's victims of persecution. There's victims of injustice, of unjust laws who are powerless to change things. There's people who are suffering from just the way the system of this world works. The economic system grinds them down. They've not committed a sin. It's this sinful world. It's a result of sin, how it's infected the world, but it's not a result of their sin. Even Jesus pointed this out when the disciples asked him and said, why did this happen? He says, of those 18 who died when the Tower of Siloam fell on them, do you think they were more guilty than all the others living in Jerusalem? When something bad happens to someone, don't leap to judgment. And that is so often where we go. We leap to judgment. We assume that they have done something wrong. Christopher Ash, he's recently written a book, a commentary on Job. I haven't read it myself, but I did hear a podcast, an interview with him. And he talked about, he went to a church and he was preaching about the book of Job and saying, you know, not all sin, not all suffering is a result of specific sin. Not something that somebody suffers is a result of somebody, something they've done in their lives necessarily. And someone came up to him afterwards and said, yeah, we just had Job preached in our church. And the preacher was making the point that what Job did wrong, he must have done something wrong, otherwise God would have blessed him. If he is doing the right thing, he would have had all his wealth and his family and his reputation and his health. So Job needed to turn his life around and sort himself out. And that's almost exact opposite of what the book is saying, what Job is saying. Kate Bowler, she's a writer. She's written about the prosperity gospel, where a lot of this thinking is coming from. And she was diagnosed with cancer. And she wrote these words in the Church Times about 10 years ago. She talked about the result and said what it was like. She wrote a piece for the New York Times about it. And she said, the first piece she wrote for the paper, while undergoing treatment in 2016, ended up on the front page of its Sunday Review and was read by millions. Her inbox was flooded with emails from strangers giving reasons. Not that they'd been asked, of course. From strangers giving reasons. A man from Idaho explained, God is a just God to let you die. That is the consequence of your sin. And I pray that none of us will be entering into that sort of judgment on people. We are so quick to judge. Jesus says, do not judge, or you too will be judged. For in the same way you judge others, you will be judged, and with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? Be very careful. We can't see clearly. Don't judge. Judge very carefully. I'm not saying don't ever make a judgment, but don't be swift to judge others. And part of the reason is we have this great plank in our own eyes so often. We're looking at our brother's eye and seeing this tiny little speck in there and this great plank. How can we see clearly when there's a plank in our eyes? And that should lead to a second point. We should examine ourselves. We should look into our own lives and say, Lord, help me. Help me to see clearly about myself so that I may see clearly to help my brother. If we are to come alongside our brother who is suffering, we need to watch ourselves that there's not pride, there's not judgmentalism, and that we have dealt with the sin in our own lives. So it's not just at communion, but through our lives as we go ahead. Now, there's one good thing that Eliphaz does say. It's in Job chapter 5 and verse 8. And he says, but if I were you, I would appeal to God. I would lay my cause before him. David Klein's in his commentary says, at least Eliphaz says one sensible thing. So that's good. Eliphaz says one sensible thing. And David Klein goes on to say what he thinks the message is. And I'm going to close more or less with this. What's the message for us? Well, there's two messages. Whether you are suffering like Job or whether you're a comforter like Eliphaz. Let Job, the patient sufferer, be your model, as long as that is possible for you. But when you cannot bear that any longer, let your grief and anger and impatience direct you towards God, for he is ultimately the origin of the suffering, and it is only through encounter with him that the anguish can be relieved. I don't want to spoil the end of the book of Job, but that's very much where we're heading. It is only in his presence. Psalm 73, the psalmist says, why do the wicked prosper? Why do, not why do bad things happen to good people, but why do good things happen to bad people? Why do the wicked prosper? But then he says, I went into the sanctuary and then I understood. And it's only as we draw near to God that we begin to see more clearly. So whether you are suffering and struggling, whatever it may be, we draw ourselves into God. And whether you've come to comfort someone, draw them into God's presence. Draw them to where they may be comfort and healing and reassurance. You may not have all the answers. You may not have a solution, but you do have a savior you can share with them. Because Job talks in chapter 9, he says, I know that my Redeemer lives, and in the end, he will stand upon the earth. He's looking forward to that. And we say, we know that Redeemer. We know that he stood upon the earth. We know that he's given his life for each one of us. And we know that he's left his spirit with us to help us see us through these dark times. Now, I'm going to finish there. There's a lot to think about in these chapters, and we're all in different places. But we can all take away that it's in God's presence that we begin to see clearly.